Thunder. Glenn's album is out this May. This is podcast 342. What I mean, what I say, Punker. Punker. You're listening to the white and blue. What I know has got to be true. Oh, Punker. Skanker. Stars, welcome on this website. Pick it up and you'll be alright. Oh, Skanker. We argue on the blue and white. Right to the podcast tonight on the news website. Till you're seething, we argue on the blue and white. Right to the podcast tonight on the Punk News website. Punker. Danzig, he's A-OK. I mean, that's what I heard today. I meant to say Punker. Skanker. Do you wanna skank with me? Pick it up on the count of three. Oh, Skanker. We argue on the blue and white. Right to the podcast tonight on the Punk News website. Till you're seething, we argue on the blue and white. Right in the podcast tonight on the Punk News website. Yeah!
And welcome back to Punk News Podcast, episode 342. We decided from now on that every episode is going to be a themed episode because I know the listeners love themed episodes. So this episode's theme is pizzazz. And so we will be delving into all topics pizzazz tonight. Adam White, pizzazz, are you pro or con pizzazz?
I've been drinking, so I am absolutely pro pizzazz. And this is the first that I have learned about this theme. So I'm fucking ready for pizzazz.
We're talking pizzazz tonight. Pros, cons. How to get into pizzazz? What do you do when you're into pizzazz? What's your next step? And what you should avoid doing when pizzazz? Ricky, in just a few words, what's your advice for the listeners regarding pizzazz?
I think Adam answered it. It's clearly alcohol.
There you go. The answer is alcohol. So in order to get some pizzazz into your life, start drinking alcohol, and that's where you'll go.
It's easier, yeah.
If you guys remember the Pee-wee's Playhouse, Ricky, did you watch Pee-wee's Playhouse?
I did.
Adam, did you watch Pee-wee's Playhouse?
So I forget if it was my grandmother or my mom, but someone at one point when I was a kid was like, "Don't watch this. It'll make you stupid." And I was not allowed to watch that show.
That's interesting because Pee-wee's Playhouse is actually a pretty intelligent show. Unlike, I don't know, like Barney or whatever. Like Barney has one level or Teletubbies have one level. Pee-wee's Playhouse has like three or four levels going on at once. You know what
but
I
like,
mean?
I'm trying to think of like what in the 80s I would have been watching instead of Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Out of like Nova.
Well, I'm thinking like fucking G.I. Joe or something. So like, all right, so I can't watch this show with like the talking toilet in it, but I can watch this one in which the American military shoots a lot of guys. So that's okay. But I can't watch the one with the talking toilet because that's stupid.
If you watch G.I. Joe, they don't actually shoot people. They shoot tanks. And the guys jump out of the tanks before it gets shot.
I know, and they all had different colored lasers to denote which team they were on, which was, you know, is unfortunately not how the real world works. Like, I remember seeing footage of Desert Storm when I was like, God, what would it have been like? When was Desert Storm? Like 91?
like 88 to 91. In first grade, I made a Desert Storm diorama.
Yeah, yeah. So I would have been, that's hilarious, actually. But no, I would have been like, I don't know, like, well, you and I are both the same age, right? So like,
yeah.
Like 9, 10, 11 or so when Desert Storm was happening. And they had, it was one of the first wars where they had like camera footage of bombs dropping on bunkers from the planes with like night vision and everything. And I'm watching this thing, this stuff on the news, and I'm like, oh, this is like old timey, because there's no, like, our bombs should be blue and all the Iraqis should be shooting red, and that's not happening. And it was really disappointing to me.
You know what I always thought about G.I. Joe is, like, in G.I. Joe, they could dodge lasers. And I was thinking, well, why don't they just use bullets? Because you can't dodge bullets. I never could figure that out.
The fact that you need to make projectiles or like, beam weapons or whatever, like, cinematically a color really sets us up to fail when the actual fighting happens. Because, John, I'm like you. I'm going to try to dodge all kinds of shit, and I'm pretty sure it all actually moves way faster than that's going to happen.
Some guy's robbing like a 7-Eleven, you're in there. It's like, don't worry, ma'am. I'll distract him and jump out of the way. The
like, I'm going to do a cool backflip over whatever they're going to shoot at me.
You like stumble over the chips. You crash into the ground and the guy shoots you. Anyways, murder and homicide. That's definitely not a part of pizzazz. The reason I brought up Pee-wee's Playhouse is because in Pee-wee's Playhouse, they would have a word of the day. Well, from going forward on Punk News Podcast, we're going to have an abstract concept of the week, which will be our theme. Pizzazz is this week. Next week might be moribund or self-loathing or pensiveness or indignation. There's any number of themes that we can have in the Punk News Podcast.
It'd be great if like 80% of the episodes could be self-loathing, and then like we have pizzazz to interspace between those.
Are we going to scream when someone says pizzazz?
I think we should. You know what? Right, well, you know that kind of that Ricky, your suggestion is filled with pizzazz.
Really? I mean, you were doing this last week with the dream car thing, right?
Dream car. All right, listen. We need to stop making the Punk News Podcast so wacky. Let's bring it back down to earth. This is a serious program.
Is it? Do you wonder if are we going to start to lose listeners because the show has become increasingly stupid?
Yeah, honestly, here's the thing. I agree. When podcasts get stupid and people talk about bullshit, I do get annoyed and stop listening. I am sorry, Punk News listeners. We will be serious. Ricky, what was your serious comment that you were about to say?
It wasn't serious. It was last time you guys went on like a 15 minute diatribe about the second Star Trek series. So I don't know what to do now.
On the last episode, in my defense, I was really high for the first half of it. So that probably has something to, that's the explainer there. I mean, this week I'm just drinking, so it's okay.
What's my defense? I wasn't high at all. I'm just talking about Star Trek.
I mean, you're just you're from Philly. You're that's like the natural drug, right?
That's true. Philly is a natural high. Speaking of natural highs and speaking of no pizzazz, but seriousness, let's reach into our mailbag. As always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. This is from Pete 45. Pete 45 says, "Dear Punk News Podcast, I love the podcast and listen every week. Please be more regular with posts. I'm writing in because you often talk about great records that or great shows that you have been to. But have you ever been really excited to get a record and it was bad? Or have you ever really looked forward to a show and have been disappointed? I often find that if I look forward to a show too much, I am let down." From Pete 45.
Wait, what did he mean by posts? I mean, we get this up fairly regularly.
I'm extremely lax about posting the stories on it, and it's probably that.
Oh,
I mean, okay. the show goes in the feed pretty well, but I've been doing this like post a story every 2 weeks because I keep forgetting things. So that's probably that. I'm sorry, people of the Punk News. I'm going to be better. Me and podcast producer Greg Simpson actually have a plan to. We're going to try to practically put these out a day earlier. So they get out on time. That's the plan. Anyways, that's not that exciting. The question was,
there's not much pizzazz that answer.
No, man. Sorry. That's fairly routine. What was the question? Shows
really
or
excited to get a record, yeah, or real excited to be on your show and it wasn't as good as you were hoping.
I mean, records all the time, right? Because you become a fan of a band, you generally become a fan of the band's. No one ever engages with the band usually on like, oh, I really like their last record, I hope the next one is good. You become once a single record from that band is good, they take on this mental construct that you've made for them that is your ideal of that band, and then you want to make sure that they live up to that. So I can't pick out one in particular, but like all kinds of times, you know, you get the next record from a band that you quote unquote like, and the record doesn't do much for you. Shows is harder for me, and I'm trying to figure this out, because in general I'm always happy to see something live. Usually when I'm not thrilled to see a band live, it has very little to do with the band and a lot to do with like circumstances surrounding the show. And I mean, the one that pops into my head, or the few that pop into my head, are like, I remember at one point in, I don't know, let's say 2004, 2005 or something like that, I was really into the New Bomb Turks, and they were playing in Toronto after their last record came out, which would have been The Night Before the Day the Earth Stood Still, that came out on Gearhead. And I got my girlfriend and my buddy from university, and we drove up to Toronto, and we went to the legendary Horseshoe Tavern, which is a totally classic venue, a pretty tiny little stage, but it's like, God, it's like 60, 70 years old. John, the Rolling Stones have played there. It's tiny. But anyway, so
actually, Adam, that's where they had their very famous Rolling Stones and B.B. King show at the, which is a famous recorded show. It's the Rolling Stones and B.B. King doing a B.B. King set.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to see this stage, like, it's crazy. It's a tiny little venue. It's just a bar, right? So, but anyway, so we go up there to see this band, and, you know, we get up there, and I don't remember exactly, but, like, either I was sick or my girlfriend was sick, and it was pissing rain, because there was a good 10-year period that whenever I went to Toronto, it was raining every single time. And then the sound was incredibly loud, like not fun loud, like everything was maxed out loud. So I just remember like kind of sitting at the back of the venue with my friend that wasn't really into it in the first place, and my girlfriend that had a fucking headache, and me that's got a cold, and we're all wet, and the band's playing, and it's just punishingly loud. And I'm like, oh, I feel bad that I've dragged everyone into this situation. But that, again, that has very little to do with the band and more to do with the circumstances around it. And I feel that's usually the case. It's usually like sound guys ruin shows for me more than...
True.
Yeah.
True. Here's my example. I went and saw the... There used to be this place in Santa Clara next to San Jose called the Avalon Nightclub. And before it was the Avalon Nightclub, it was a Chuck E. Cheese. And no, actually, after it was a Chuck E. Cheese, and before it was Avalon, it was a non-licensed Chuck E. Cheese with other Chuck E. Cheese type robotics, but not the Chuck E. Cheese ones. And I went and I saw the Misfits there, and I had seen the Misfits about 8 times. And this is the Jerry, Eric Archie, Des Cadena version. And it was just so loud and so muddy sounding. Like, I couldn't even tell what song it was. I was just bummed out. But like Adam says, when I go and have a bad time at shows, most of the bands I go to, like, I don't go to a lot of bands that I, like, most of the bands I'm into kick ass live. So it's rare that I go to a show and the band themselves are not good. I'm usually pretty happy or pretty excited with the band, but it's usually the state of mind that I'm at. And a little while ago, I went and saw Modo. You guys know Modo, Masters of the Obvious?
No.
They're this cult band that's been around for about 30 years. I actually just learned about them. But they're pretty cool, and they played in the middle of Nowheresville, Pennsylvania, in this tiny, tiny garage called the Skid Row Garage. About 20 people were there, and I was looking forward to it, although I was a little tired. And so I get there, and there's this jackass kid. I don't know how he could have been anywhere from 18 to 24. My guess, about 20. Might have been like 17. He was throwing firecrackers. And like I'm like what an asshole. And then one of the firecracker like flames like hit my neck and like really pissed me off, because I was in kind of a bad mood to begin with because I got there too early. So I go over to this kid. I'm like, listen, you need to cut that out. And he goes, I'll do whatever the fuck I want to do. I'll throw a firecracker. I'm like, listen, if you throw a firecracker again, you're going to have a problem. And then I walked away. And then he was like, then across the room, he's like, fight me, man. Let's fight. Meanwhile, he was not a big guy. And whenever someone says, fight me, let's fight, you know what that means?
I don't know, John, because you're the one that's always in these situations, and I'm not.
It means I'm not going to fight you because I'm scared. If someone wants to fight you, they don't say I'm going to fight you. They throw a fist at you. You know what I mean? So I just ignored the guy, and I left about halfway through because I'm thinking, you know what, man? Like, this kid's a jackass. I'm not really enjoying myself. And if he's got like a knife or something, then I'm going to have a problem. So I left. So I was having a bad time. And it was on me.
I don't think you need to qualify the fact that flames touched you with you were having a bad day. Like, flames touching you should be really the bare minimum for you getting mad at something without needing an explanation or a qualifier.
Yeah, I mean, I was just having a, like, I don't know, I was in a bad mood to begin with, and this idiot kid's throwing firecrackers.
Yes, but John, fire touched you. You could have been in a great mood, and then fire touched you, you were fully justified in now not, know, like, in becoming irate at that situation.
I mean, I was thinking of punching the kid, but then, you know, if I punch this kid, he's going to sue me, you know what I mean? And is he going to learn his lesson? No. So I was thinking, I'll just go scare him, and I think I did scare him. But will he change his behavior? Probably not. You know what I mean? So, I mean, and also, like, I was in an area that I'm not usually into, so maybe he's got friends around, and, you know, those kind of guys never fight you one-on-one. It's always 5-on-1, so I'm like, whatever. So anyway, I had a bad time, but I usually have good times. I saw Crazy in the Brains again and this past week, and Posers, and Paul Collins in the Beat, and Protex. Posers and Crazy in the Brains, they should be the most famous bands there are. Crazy in the Brains are amazing. Everyone needs to listen to Crazy in the Brains. I'm sorry, Ricky, you got a story or no story?
Oh, yeah, I do. Yeah. I mean, but you can continue. But
that's my story. Crazy in the Brains are awesome. My good experiences far outweigh my bad experiences. And Crazy in the Brains are just on fire. And I mean, maybe they will become very popular. I mean, they've been around for about 5 years now. But man, I mean, they're just amazing. I don't know why they're not. And whenever I see them play, they blow people away. But I don't know why they're not like the most famous band in the world. Well, not the world, but I don't know why they're not making a lot of money.
Huh. A bad show. You know, for me, I've never been. You know, if I go to a show where I'm going to see the headlining band, I've never really had a bad experience with that. I mean, but it's usually it's like some of the opening bands that drive me crazy, that just kind of make the show seem a lot longer. I reviewed, you know, the first time I saw Rancid was with the Interrupters and the Transplants, and I mean, that was before the Interrupters released anything. That was right when the Transplant Wars of 2014 or something like that, when on the podcast. And those were just, those two were just, oh my God, it just felt like forever until Rancid got on.
I thought you liked the Interrupters.
Back then, I'm talking about, in context of...
You didn't like them then, but you like them now?
No, I mean, their last record was okay. I still wasn't thrilled, but anyway.
Did they play a headlining set when they were an opener? That's always the worst, when a band's...
I don't remember. Mm. I think they might have put on 45 minutes.
Mm.
That's still a lot.
If you're an intro, 30 minutes, unless you're opening for like Metallica or something, 30 minutes.
Yeah,
max.
And then I think the Transplants did an hour, and then like Rancid did an hour and a half or something like that. It was just too much. Then, you know, like at Punk Rock Bowling last year, I mean, all the bands are great, but like the Exploited were just difficult to get through.
Why? Because they were boring?
It just wasn't good. It just didn't sound good at all. But the rest of, and I wouldn't blame the
sound guy. It was all in the band.
Sound guy, this one, because like all the other bands were sounding fine. And then you know, I love Leftover Crack, the band, but sometimes their shows can be hit or miss.
Yeah.
And so I went to see, this should have been an amazing show because the lineup was awesome. It was Blackbird Rom, War on Women, Leftover Crack, and Anti-Flag. But the thing was, they fucked up. The venue fucked up like royally. And so there's, for the Observatory in Santa Ana, there's the Constellation Room, which is like a tiny room that's like a venue. And then you have the actual Observatory, which is a very big room that could probably hold 1,000 people, probably more. They double booked Kid Cudi for the bigger room. And so what they did was they had the opening bands that they had one band and then Blackbird Rom and War on Women in the smaller Constellation Room. And then once they were done, they made everyone wait, like, I'm not kidding, 45 minutes to an hour to get into the next room because they're cleaning up and letting out the Kid Cudi people. They were cleaning up the stage too. It was insane. And we were just, you just had like a few hundred people just waiting behind closed doors, totally squished in. And it was just awful. And then, Leftover Crack, they put on an okay show, but they, they tried doing that, that introspect cover that they did on their last record, which was War at Home. And they just screwed it up so badly. Now I'm stoked to hear it, but, yeah. And then, you know, I'm not a huge Anti-Flag fan, so I kind of got out of the pit for them, but, that was, yeah, so that time the venue screwed it up royally. In terms of records, though, I mean, I don't usually get a lot of duds. If I take a chance on a band and I'd be like, okay, yeah, I'm willing to check this out, a lot of the times it's sort of like, I may have regretted buying it, but I feel like I'm pretty good on what I buy. And then there's also like records where I'll check out, I'll wait, and I won't even pre-order. I'll wait till the MP3s come out to see if I actually want it or not. But that happens very rarely that I end up buying a record that I think is bad on vinyl. So
can I interject with a weird Agnostic Front story that happened literally 2 days ago?
Yes, sure. Only if it has pizzazz. Does the story have pizzazz?
It kind of has pizzazz because I totally felt, I didn't know what I was supposed to feel after this situation. So I'm
surprised you went to see Agnostic Front.
I didn't go to see Agnostic Front. So we had a, I have a client of mine. Everyone shall remain nameless here. That was having a issue of the technical nature. So I stopped by their facilities to deal with said issue. And they were the kind of client that in their lobby, in their area where the customers come in, they were playing this loop of like various 90s punk rock over the speakers in their gift shop area kind of thing.
Is it a hip company or is it like a doctor's office?
It was a haunted house, John. A haunted house.
Okay. So that's got pizzazz.
That has pizzazz, right? So I am in the lobby of the haunted house, and I'm interacting with the gentlefolk that work the haunted house, which are folk of a certain salt, let's say. Like if you're gonna work in a haunted house, you're a certain kind of dude, right?
They had some real pizzazz.
So you had some pizzazz, and there's all this like 90s punk rock is playing on their Muzak as I'm there trying to solve the problem. And as I solve the problem, the song Gotta Go by Agnostic Front is on the thing, which a lot of people will know even if they're not Agnostic Front fans, because it was on one of the Punkorama comps in like 99 or 2000 or 98 or something like that. So a lot of people who aren't even Agnostic Front people know the song Gotta Go by Agnostic Front, or would know it to hear it. And I solve the problem and we're all happy, and I make some sort of comment where I'm like, it was the Agnostic Front. It was just the good luck song for us. And then everyone in the room stares at me like I'm a fucking alien. Because no one knows that was an Agnostic Front song. No one, I think it was the kind of situation where like, I'm like, ooh, 90s Epitaph ska punk, right? Like I'm in, I know all these songs. But to them, it was just like the work music that they've heard 600 times on repeat and therefore mentally ignore.
I like how they're looking at you like you're the weird one in the haunted house.
I'm like, yeah, I'm like, again, you guys work in a haunted house. Don't look at me like I'm the weird one here because I know this Agnostic Front song. But yeah, no one knew. And I felt kind of like a dummy. I'm like, all right, never mind. Bye.
Not to drag this out, but Adam, I imagine your job is actually pretty stressful and that people will call you up with a problem and you have to go there and you have no idea if you'll be able to figure out the problem or not, right?
Sure. I mean, infrequently, but yes. I mean, I don't know. I'm a developer. I'm a computer programmer, whatever you want to call it. So like, yeah, I make things. So sometimes people call them stuff because something isn't working and the reason is variant.
So I mean, like, so if someone says, Adam, our software is not working, like, do you say to yourself, oh man, I hope I can figure this out? Or is it to you like, all right, I know how to figure this out, it's not going to be a problem? Like, what's your mental state?
There's a lot of stuff that's in the chain usually. So usually it's one of those like, our stuff isn't working, and my initial reaction is, oh God, oh God, oh God, panic. And then I ask like a follow-up question. And it usually, like 98% of the time, is like, it's not working, comma, unrelated, we made this drastic change. Mm. And it was like, oh, okay, it's not working because you made this drastic change, but you didn't lead with that. Usually, what I find, John, is that there's causality to things in the world. But when people are having the problem, they don't lead with the causality. So a lot of the time, it sounds like there's some mystery problem you're going to have to investigate. But it's usually just that, like, someone changed something. Like, everything was working up until X, and now it's not working, but we're not going to tell you the X. So a big part of the job is, like, what was the X?
And like, is it because they're embarrassed, or they're scared to admit that they messed it up, or they just don't know?
Honestly, it's a lot of time, like, various cooks in the kitchen. When you're dealing with a lot of small businesses and technology stuff, like, there's a lot of people that might be involved, and they don't all know what connects to what and who's doing what and what is the consequence of changing this or that, and that is usually the cause, I guess. This is super interesting to our punk rock listeners, isn't it?
I think people are interesting. I imagine the Adam White walking into, like, these office buildings. He's got on like a big blazer. He's got on dark sunglasses, tight jeans, Nike high tops. You know, the sleeves of his jacket are rolled up. He's like, Mr. Pizzazz is here, and he's going to fix it for you. Let's pull out some another. We're already half hour in, and we're not even through mail.
That's okay. The stories on this episode that we actually have to get through are thin. So whatever.
So listen. This is from Kelly Ibeam. And here's what Kelly Ibeam has to say. Lay off Dream Car. It is pretty good. I had been a fan of AFI ever since Sing the Sorrow in middle school. It might not be your thing, but try to have an open mind. Davey has always said that he was a fan of the 1980s dance club music, and this is his tribute to it. Give it a shot. And then she puts in parentheses, I actually think you talking about Dream Car is funny, but I thought I had to stand up for it. It's better than most music on the radio, at least. From Kelly Ibeam.
No.
Oh, it's not that bad. It really isn't that bad. It's way better than people thought it was going to be. It is very,
because everyone had such low expectations.
Now, listen, it's not that
bad. Would I agree? Because I actually heard it on the radio, I think last week, and I'm like, but to her point in parentheses, I guess, it is better than everything else on the radio. That's still not saying much. Man. So
I think this week's episode is theme is now indignancy, being indignant. Listen, you can always reach us at podcast@punknews.org.
Hold on. I feel like that was way too harsh an answer.
Why?
I was trying to step up. I said it's not that bad, although I actually wish they had Gwen singing over it. I think it could have been a great album. I guess it doesn't say much for Davey.
That's the thing. Like, there's only one song out. I mean, I don't understand how this person can be so into it when there's one song.
She's not saying it's the best thing ever. She just said it was okay.
I feel that, like, 85% of our making fun of Dream Car is because they're called Dream Car. And it was called anything else. Even if it was called Davey Havoc's, you know, middle of the road new wave project, we would all be like, all right, it's middle of the road, sure. And we wouldn't be all that incest about it. But it's they call it Dream Car, which invites, I can't even.
How could they not expect hate? Or at least a little bit of rib poking.
I'm sure it was purposeful in that they were trying to do like let's give it like the most 80s name possible, but
yeah, I mean, this is like White Lion or whatever that band's called.
Oh, hold on.
Here we go on the road again.
Speaking of 80s stuff, because of the internet, and I don't exactly know what led me down this road, very soon before we recorded this episode, I watched the music video for the Kenny Loggins song Danger Zone.
And, very topical.
Yes, and well, it was from 1986, so it's 80s, so it's fitting into the theme right now. Right? So it is the laziest music video that I've ever seen, and I'm sort of amazed by it. Because, and this will actually loop in later in the episode when we talk about an Against Me video, but there is, Like, so like Danger Zone was from the Top Gun soundtrack. So as you'd sort of expect, like most of the video is just like spliced footage from Top Gun, and that's okay. But the actual parts in which Kenny Loggins is singing, or like lip syncing as it's a video, he's just lying on a bed. He's not even getting up. He's lying on a bed. Like, if you think about, like, so this video is going to be low effort in the first place because it's going to be like mostly movie footage that we're going to play with a song over. But on the few scenes of this video in which you, the performer of the song, need to appear, you're not even going to get up. And he's not even doing anything interesting. He's just in a bed. He's like in a hotel, lying in a bed, lip syncing to his song for, you know, a few torturous seconds before they mercifully cut to some Top Gun footage and then come back to him lying in a bed. It's sort of amazing from that standpoint. And I encourage you, the Punk News Podcast listener, to go watch the Kenny Loggins video for Danger Zone. Anyways, continue.
End of podcast. No, as always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. Adam White, I believe you had a moment earlier this week that was not pizzazzful. Is that true?
Oh, well, what happened to me? What'd I do?
This thing, Adam, you posted a thing on our notes.
Oh, Adam's a dummy. There we go. No, that was looped right into the record collecting thing. We were going to talk about records this week because all the stories are boring. Before we get into that, I just wanted to make mention of my really stupid Discogs moment from today and yesterday. If for no other reason than I feel that like admitting my dumb failures to the public makes them have less power over me. So, John, you and I have talked before on this show about how I sort of paradoxically have a million CDs but hate them.
Yes, we have.
Okay.
And I can't fathom it because I love CDs.
Right, right. So I've decided that the one good thing I can do with the million CDs I have is sell them all on Discogs and then use that money to build like a war chest to get the vinyl I want. So
I can support that.
So this has become a thing in my life where I've gone and I've listed like, I don't know how many, I've probably listed about like 80 of the CDs at this point. And sure enough, people want them for some fucking reason. And I send them to them and then they PayPal me money and that money sits in this PayPal heap. And then the PayPal heap I use to buy records. So it's working out wonderfully because this whole record habit is not affecting my family's finances too much right now because it's coming out of the PayPal heap that was being generated by the bins of old CDs anyways. So wonderful for everyone. So earlier, some guy from the Netherlands, John, he says, I need this copy of Teenage Bottle Rocket's Warning Device that you have on CD. And I said, absolutely, sir. I will sell you that copy of Warning Device. Let me go figure out what the cost of shipping is to the Netherlands. So I go to my bins of CDs and I fish out a copy of Teenage Bottle Rocket's Total, and then I put it in a package, and then I go and I get it post officed, and they say, okay, it's gonna cost you like, you know, whatever, like $10 to ship a CD to the Netherlands or whatever it is. So I go and I tell the person it's gonna cost $10, and they say, great, send me the CD. So I package it up and I send it to them, except that they did not order Teenage Bottle Rocket's Total. They asked for Teenage Bottle Rocket's Warning Device, which, in my defense, has the same fucking cover. All those records look the same. So I ship it, and I come back, and I'm like cleaning up my emails in Discogs, and I'm like, oh, motherfucker. And I go and I look, and like, sure enough, I've shipped them a copy of Total. So I send a message to the guy, and I'm like, hi, I'm like a complete dickwad, and I sent you the wrong Teenage Bottle Rocket CD. So tomorrow, I'll send you the right Teenage Bottle Rocket CD, and you can keep both of them because I'm a dick. So just letting you know that. I may have worded it differently. And then I had to like take this like shame drive to the post office today to remail the CD that the dude actually purchased. And I partially blame Red Scare Records for this because they must have encouraged this, where all the covers, the Teenage Bottle Rocket CDs, look identical.
Adam, why are you selling live at Folsom Prison? That's an amazing, amazing album.
Yeah, it is, but here's the thing about,
and you're selling damn Adam, we need to have an intervention here.
No, I'm selling lots of CDs. I just sold a copy of Black Market Clash to some guy in Texas. Here's the thing, John, and anyone who wants to peruse the Adam White store and buy my things, because please, by all means, these CDs, wonderful and life-changing they may be, have been for what year is it right now?
2017.
Okay, when did I graduate from university?
I don't know.
Ricky, you know this. You're my biographer.
2005.
Yeah, so 2005, right? So since then-ish, they have been migrating from shelf to shelf, from you know, abode to abode in my life, but have increasingly tailed off in actually being played, because at some point I ripped them all and put them on a hard drive, and then at some point, because I could put them on an iPod, and then at some point I got rid of the iPod and just had the phone, and then streaming became a thing, and I realized even the stuff I ripped I don't fucking need, because I can just stream it from anything. So now I'm sort of in this I don't need any possessions, and I'm living this monastic life, except that I do need possessions, but those possessions are records, not CDs. So now I just have these bins of things that are great to someone, but if I really objectively look at my life, I have not touched in at least 6 years.
I can't believe you're selling the Slits album.
Buy it, people. Come on, buy the Slits. It's great. I mean, again, the Slits album is great, but it's in a bin in my basement. I'm not going to touch it.
Have you tried listening to it? These things are much better.
The only CD player. No, if I wanted to listen to the Slits in any immediate sense, I would just probably open up iTunes and listen to the Slits, right? I have easy access to the sound. If I wanted to listen to the Slits in a way that I was really gonna experience the music deeply, I would probably get the record and put the record on. So the CD for me is a weird in between, where I don't have a regular CD player in my life, so it doesn't have the convenience factor. And at the same time, so digital music is more convenient. And if I really want to, if I want to fucking make love to the record, then I'm going to do it on vinyl. So the CD is just sort of there. It's just a thing I own. So I'm just looking at it as a bank. It is money that could be transferred into something else.
You know what's amazing is Adam White and I are yin and yang in that literally this week, after about 6 years of questing, I got the double CD version of the Slits' first album. And just to spite Adam White, I'm going to play at the end of the episode a track from that.
It's great. It's a great record. Don't get me wrong. I am by no means commenting on the music that are on these things. It's just that they don't factor into my life. So why? I feel that I'm on these things have a limited shelf life. At some point, the universe is going to decide that, no, CDs, are potentially not what we want anymore. I'm not encouraging that, John. If that doesn't happen, then great, because I have a perpetual source of income here. But if that's not the case, and suddenly the universe decides that no one wants CDs anymore, then what am I going to fucking do with all these things? There's a million of them. That said, if you are a listener of the Punk News Podcast, and I'm not trying to sell anyone anything right now, if you're a listener of the Punk News Podcast, I'm being serious now, and you want a ton of promo stuff. And by promo stuff, I mean absolutely usable, otherwise perfect quality, in a lot of cases, compact discs that just happen to have the barcode burned out on them or crossed out or cut out or whatever. I'm not selling that stuff because it's promo stuff. It's not really mine to sell, and it's kind of mangled up anyways. If you want a bunch, get in touch with me, adam@punknews.org, because I will give you, if you want a bunch of punk promo things and you want to pay for the postage of it, then I will gladly deplastic these CDs and pack as many of them into a thing as I can and ship them to you. And if they make your life better, great.
I can actually vouch for this, because remember I bought the Sticks and Stones CD from
and
you?
I sent you as much shit as I could fit in, yeah, reasonably.
I just got this giant I got like this giant pile of what must have been 20 CDs.
Yeah.
What'd you get, Ricky?
I don't even remember. I mean, there...
A bunch of horse crap. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's what it was. And I had to like sift through them to find the one I actually bought. The one I actually bought from you.
Ricky was prospecting for CDs. I imagine he's got like one of these big floppy hats and overalls. And he's got like that string wire basket. And he's like...
John, I feel that you got into the punk news racket a few years after the CD madness had ebbed. And... There was a time, John, where, and I was a student. I was going to my student mailbox in like 2003, and every day it was just packed with packages of CDs, and to the point where like it stopped being wonderful and started being maddening, because I'm like, I don't have any food today, but I have 500 CDs. This is great. Yeah.
Yeah, but you could have flipped them back then.
Oh man, I flipped lots of shit. But I'm just saying, there was a point where CDs were raining upon me from the sky in a way that was not pleasant. And now they've taken this role in my life that is sort of like a yoke. They're a boulder that is tied to me, and I've just lived my life dragging this heap of CDs everywhere. So,
what's that Greek legend? The guy that always has the boulder, he has to roll up the hill.
Sisyphus.
Yeah.
Anyways, so there, I'm dumb. I shipped the wrong CD to the Netherlands. That's my story.
Sucks, man.
Anyways, wow, we're really far into this show.
Play a tune. Let's come back and we'll talk about some music stuff.
Yeah.
And we'll burn through stuff as quickly as we can.
Sure. Okay. So one of the things that I did was I took some of this selling shit on the internet money that I had made. And then I was like, all right, so I've sold some Teenage Bottle Rocket CDs to the Netherlands. What do I do with this influx of cash? And the answer is buy mid-90s Canadian surf rock music from the UK. So I went and I just purchased a copy of the Huevos Rancheros 1995 record Dig In from some dude in England. And the dude in England was like, during the purchase, was like, hey, I got a bunch of singles from this band. Do you want the singles?
Badass.
I'm like, yeah, what's that mean? Do I want the singles? Like, what are we talking here? And he's like, well, I got these three singles from the early 90s. And if I add them in, it's going to like increase your shipping cost by £3 or something. I'm like, do it. So this is all in the mail. And I'm really happy about this because that was honestly the first live band I had ever seen. So this is a song from the Huevos Rancheros from the 1995 record Dig In. It is called Rockin' in the Hen House.
Ay, caramba. We'll be right back.
and that was Rockin' in the Hen House by Huevos Rancheros, which means country eggs, right? Is that what that means? Huevos Rancheros?
Yeah, I've always assumed it meant like, I don't know if it was like spicy eggs or like rancher eggs or whatever. It's egg something. It's an eggs dish you can get in the States that is like salsa and stuff. Yeah.
Ranchero means country, but it can mean like spicy or rancher. You know what I mean? Anyways, yeah. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast. Listen, the main man. Well, not the main man. Adam White's the main man. Adam will always be the main man. But the main dark man. The man that.
That was not phrased right.
the man with lots of pizzazz, the man Glenn Danzig, he's announced his first new studio album of original material in 7 years, and not only that, it will be out in a matter of eight small weeks, whereas album lead times used to be 6 months or a year. Now it seems the record labels are playing with very short lead up times, and the new Danzig album will be out in mid-May. However, I should qualify this as Danzig loves to announce projects and then have them never come through. He announced an Elvis covers EP. We have not seen hide nor hair of that since it was announced. He announced a 12-inch single of Black Hell off Hangover 2 soundtrack, which I was really excited to get. We have not seen hide nor hair of that since it was announced. He announced a 12-inch re-release of Who Killed Marilyn, his first solo record. We have not seen hide nor hair of that since it was announced, and I want all of those items. However, Danzig, he's got a new album coming out. His last studio album was original studio album was Death Red Sabbath, and pretty much all the Danzig fans agreed that it was fantastic. It was almost retro in that it was Danzig doing metal, but almost 70s metal, produced and recorded on an analog machine, and it was great. Tom Trauma boohooed it, but that's Tom Trauma. Are you guys excited for this? Is Danzig the man? And also, do you think we'll see this in mid-May, or will we see significant delays? And the Misfits. Will we ever see the Misfits again? Is this going to put them on hold forever? Is this going to knock it out forever? Or is Danzig just going to do the Misfits thing like once every other year for a festival where he gets tons of cash rather than touring to death for little bucks?
Yeah, I was actually going to ask. I guess this means we're not going to get a new Misfits record?
You probably not, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of hoping they were going to release like Live at Riot Fest. Like, I was sort of hoping for a recording of that. Other than that, I've never been into Danzig solo stuff that much. So, he can take as long as he wants for me. I don't really care.
Wow!
What a dick!
Ooh, that was harsh.
How is that harsh?
That you just told him he could just fuck off and die is what you said.
No, I said he can take as long as he wants because it doesn't affect me.
Yeah, that's more or less.
That's so different.
You know how that would hurt Danzig's feeling? He's put his heart and soul into this over the past 7 years, and you just said, meh, whatever. It's not very thoughtful, Ricky. There's not much pizzazz in that, let me tell you.
Here's the one thing I know about Danzig. Don't take pictures, okay? I'll stay out of his way and I won't take any pictures.
I did not grow up with Danzig's solo stuff. Like I had heard the Misfits, of course, but the solo stuff, for whatever reason, I never decided to pursue. Last year or the year before or something like that, probably John, at your behest, I went and I dug into the Danzig back catalog.
Ooh.
And I'm into it. But I haven't had a record come out at the point when I was aware. But I am now aware, John, I am woke to Danzig. So now I'm kind of into this. Like, I kind of want to, you know, I want to hear the single at the same point when everyone else hears the single and react to that. So I'm kind of looking forward to that. Is this thing going to actually, is it going to come out? I don't know. That's up to you.
I'm thinking it will, because he said mid-May and a short release date. I do think it's interesting that there hasn't been a Danzig album in 7 years, not counting the covers album. And it's like, oh, it's going to be out in 8 weeks. Like, that's an incredibly short lead-up time, but I guess all the labels are experimenting with marketing now. I had something else. Oh, but here's something that's weird is, you know, famously, when the Misfits announced those two shows, I was like, don't waste your money, don't waste your money. They're going to tour, don't waste your money. And of course, they're not touring. But for some reason, I'm not that disappointed that I didn't get to see the Misfits. Maybe because I've seen Danzig and Doyle do the Misfits a bunch, or maybe because it's not really, really the Misfits, you know, or maybe it's because I've got to see Samhain which I guess I thought was even less probable than seeing the Misfits. But I'm extremely excited to see this, and I'm not really bummed out that I didn't see the Misfits at all. I don't know why.
I sort of feel like if you were one of the people that were at those shows, then, you know, you should be totally excited and happy that you got to see that. And if you weren't at those shows, I think it's okay to not have to, you know, you're not going to experience like a secondary product to that. Like, you know, you weren't there, too bad. But, you know, don't feel bad that you didn't see like the cash-in tour that would inevitably be sort of worse. Like,
yeah.
Like, not everything gets to be for everyone when it comes to a live event. Like, if you missed the live event, that live event does not have any obligation to like show up on your doorstep and perform for you. Like, you missed it. So it was a live thing. That was it.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was really cool that they got back together for Riot Fest, and if they toured, I would have gone. Who knows how much that ticket would have cost.
Probably like $60.
Yeah, before fees.
Yeah. Probably 45 to 60. Because Sam Hain was 30 and Danzig is like 30. Like, Sam Hain and Danzig are like 30 or 35. So Misses would probably be about 50, I think, before fees.
Yeah. So, you know, if they toured, I'd go, but am I like pissed off I didn't jump on a plane and go to Riot Fest? Not really. I mean, seeing the Jerry only led Misfits was fine, I guess. But that was my question. Does he ever explain why his releases like don't come out?
The answer is no. My guess is it's almost assuredly one of two things. The first thing, which I don't think it is, but it could be financial mismanagement in that he can't get the money backing that he, like, you know, Danzig sold a lot of records in the 90s. Same with Morrissey. So, you know, they might call up a record company and they might be expecting $500,000 or $1 million. And the record company's like, we can give you $30,000. You know what I mean? Because records don't sell anything anymore. So it could just be that he's got these plans, but he doesn't want to put his own money into it, which is probably part of it. Or the other thing is, Danzig is famously a perfectionist, and I think that shows through in his music, and that although like Danzig 5 was not that good, it was experimental, he doesn't put out stuff that he thinks is half-assed. Everything he puts out is something that he feels he gave 100% to. If you look at the Misfits box set, the Sam Hain box set, those are all incredibly well-done things. Death Red Sabbath, the album, the music was great, but also the packaging was great. So I think for Danzig, putting out new stuff isn't really the most important thing on his radar right now, or in general, because there's lots of old stuff he could re-put out. He just isn't. And I think he doesn't want to half-ass it. So I think in his brain, he's like, well, I have to oversee this. But he hasn't like sat down and thought it through, because meanwhile, he's working on other stuff. That's my guess. It's one of those two things, I think.
Huh.
Well, listen, I'm super excited for this. What else can we say? Danzig, I can't wait to see him live. He says he's going to do some tour dates for Danzig 3, and he's going to do most of those tracks. I know all the punk rockers now are too cool for Danzig, but Danzig is friggin' awesome, man. Like, I don't know where this too cool for school attitude comes from, but Danzig rules. And speaking of one of Danzig's idols, and we'll just blow through this quickly, but David Bowie, well, he's dead, but the estate of David Bowie is going to re-release two rare David Bowie albums for Record Store Day. The first is the famous and rare Bo Promo CD. Adam White, do you have the album Hunky Dory? Well, I guess you don't, because you sold your CD, but have you heard the album Hunky Dory?
I have, and I could totally have that as a record, but I don't.
Bo Promo is a very interesting record in that before Hunky Dory was released, the record company shipped out alternate mixes to like DJs and stuff just to say, here's our new guy, David Bowie. And it also famously has different mixes on it, but also the rare track Bombers. Bombers was later re-released on the Ryko version of Hunky Dory, which is pretty rare, and it's a great track. And even David Bowie stated he doesn't know why that was left off Hunky Dory. So they're re-releasing the Bo Promo record, which is in an essence an alternate mix of Hunky Dory. So that's very exciting. And I actually right now bootlegs, if you bought an original Bo Promo record, it would be like $600. No, it's like $6,000. the bootlegs are like 40. I was bought a bootleg just to hear it, but now that I can get an official release, I'm very excited to check that out. So that's very interesting. The other thing is maybe not quite as interesting, but still pretty cool. It's David Bowie, Cracked Acker, live in Los Angeles, 1974. It's a live record from the Diamond Dogs tour, which is interesting. The Diamond Dogs tour is the tour where David Bowie kind of did Philly Soul. The only thing, I guess, detracting from that is this tour has already been documented as the David Live album, which is David doing the Diamond Dogs tour. No, I'm wrong. The David Live record is from, not Diamond Dogs, Young Americans. This is from the album before that. So this is, wow. So this record will be one of the last documents of Ziggy Stardust. This is cool.
John, you didn't realize this before reading this story?
My brain always mixes up Diamond Dogs with Young Americans because the covers both have like the same kind of airbrush look to them.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
So this is cool.
That's cool. That is cool. Now, these are record store day releases. Is there, I'm just scanning the story here. Is there word on how rare this stuff will be? Is it'll be available or is it?
No, but we're looking at like, I mean, honestly, like record store day prices dropped for a while, but this past record store day record prices shot way back up. I told the story of, I wanted to buy that Rolling Stones 10-inch single with one song on it and it was $35. So I had to put it back. So with these bad boys, we're looking at like, $40 for Bow promo, probably $60 to $70 for the live record, which is out. Honestly, it's outrageous. It really is, you know. So I don't even know if I'm going to buy them or what I'm going to do, man. It's like I don't want to blow $100 on two records. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, that's the.
I feel abused. I feel I'm being taken advantage of. I feel there's no pizzazz in artificially inflating record prices.
Well, you can. You know, listen to them on YouTube like a tool later. Isn't that disappointing that when you have to resort to that? Doesn't that feel like defeat? Or like, I can, like, there's this rare song. I'm really trying to track it down. And I guess I can just listen to it on YouTube like a dick. And then,
like a dick.
I don't know. I always feel like I'm doing something. I'm consuming it in the worst way possible.
Yeah, YouTube does sound crappy. However, YouTube is, I mean, this is not a novel idea, but like it is crazy how like some obscure Australian demo tape from 1979 is on YouTube.
No, it's amazing, but it just always slightly feels like it takes the wind out of your sails of like tracking down this rare thing. Where like, I found this super rare pressing of whatever, and it's like, oh, that was on YouTube 7 years ago. You could just go listen to it on your phone.
I see. You find it depressing in that your quest was in vain.
I mean, in vain, but like, in that there is a probably inferior sounding version of it easily available. But I don't want to. Like, yeah. I don't want to go listen to it on YouTube. I don't want my experience with this record to be that I'm gonna sit here with like 45 web browser windows open and scroll through Reddit while it plays in the background of a tab. Like that just seems like the most horrible way to interact with art. But a lot of times it comes down to that.
True that, but also sometimes stuff sounds crappy on YouTube and hear the actual thing and it sounds great, you know, but technology, bah humbug.
Anyways, Ricky, yeah. Play a song here.
Okay, so I'm going to do something a little different than I usually do on here. I actually have an acoustic song I'm going to play, and this is a song from... Well, they were Andrew Jackson Jihad when this came out, but AJJ's live album, Live at the Crescent Ballroom, which is their last release on Asian Man Records before they switched over to Side One Dummy. For a contemporary live record, it is criminally overlooked and underrated. It is so, so good. They're a full band there, but I don't think it's like the official band, like full band that they have now when Christmas Island came out. So this came out in 2013. And they released a couple of new, they actually released a couple of new songs ahead of Christmas Island when this came out. Like Coco Pelli Face Tattoo ended up being on Christmas Island, but there's one song that didn't end up anywhere really. And I'm just kind of shocked they didn't do anything more with it. It's called Hashtag Armageddon. It's some of the best lyrics ever. They're so, it's funny, it's dark, it's so vivid, and so they're so vivid. So I'm gonna play that. I think you can find, they can find it on like a comp they released a little while after, but still, this is they never really did an official recording for it, and they, and I wish they would, because it's so great. So here is the live version of Hashtag Armageddon by AJJ from their album Live at the Crescent Ballroom.
Oh God, there's a big one coming on. The dead have begun to rise and walk, and nobody is singing. Nobody is singing. The bottomless pit has opened up. The Virgin Mary is crying blood, and nobody is singing. Nobody is singing. We're all taking pictures with camera phones to prove that we were there. For the end of days, the end of days. The blood golem is on the loose again. He doesn't know that we're American. He just thinks we're fatter. The hell demons are killing all in sight. Satan's doing wheelies on his bike. Twin heads on his handlebars. Pigtail twins around the age of six, six, six. Their faces painted to look like King Diamond and Peter Chris. For the end of days, the end of days. Now it's raining semen. It smells like those summer trees you smell. Could this be the revelation? Or is it simply the end of hell? Coming on, hashtag Armageddon. That topic is trending. The death cult is making jewelry from the corpses they dragged from the burning sea. They're taking eyes, they're taking ears. They're taking noses, they're taking teeth, they're taking hair and skin from tattoos, they're taking fingers, they're taking the end of days very seriously. And now the valley is flooded with piranha, tequila, and knives. But at least we got to prove that we did something worthwhile with our lives. At the end of days, the end of days.
Thanks.
And that was AJJ doing Armageddon. Ricky, do you know who was a special guest in the AJJ band on that recording?
Jeff Rosenstock.
Indeed. Plus 5 points to Ricky.
Who I saw last night.
How was that?
It was, you know, the show was Roswell Kid, Jeff Rosenstock, and the Menzingers. It was great. I'm going to review it later, but it was, the I hadn't seen the Menzingers in like 2.5 years. They didn't really come out here as headliners. So the last time I saw them, it was them and Pop. Everyone's phenomenal last night. It was really a great show.
Well, there you have it. Ricky giving a thumbs up to Jeff Rosenstock out in L.A. Speaking of another Ricky band, this is the quintessential Ricky band, Against Me.
Yes, it is.
They've released, Ricky, is this your favorite band?
They have been for a while. I mean, it switches all the time. Also, I mean, they've probably gone down a peg or two just because. I mean, it's not like I think they're trash. It's just that the last album was not what I was hoping for.
It didn't have as much pizzazz as you were hoping it would have.
I was hoping for more pizzazz.
Fair enough. Yeah. Well, Against Me, they've released a video for their song Haunting Haunted Haunts. It's off their recently released album, I guess from last year, Shapeshift With Me, that was out last year via Total Treble. I know Adam White had thoughts on this video. I've got thoughts myself. Adam White, did this video have enough pizzazz for you?
No, I mean, I don't want to... It's some neat animation work from someone. It's like a kaleidoscopic line work thing, which is, I mean, what struck me about it more than anything was that it feels very internet era to me, which is to say, it is the kind of video that you throw on, you know, as you're within the context of listening to music online. So, you know, you pop it up in your Facebook feed or in a tweet or something like that, and it plays and does all this fun little line work in a little window, and that's how you interact with it. And from that context, it sort of works. I was looking at it and I was thinking earlier, and I don't know if this is just because I was watching Kenny Loggins' videos earlier, but I was looking at it and thinking, like, would this work in, like, 1996?
No way.
Like, me sitting around watching, for me watching Much Music, but for you guys watching MTV, right? So, like, yeah. would this work watching it, you know, on your TV as a teenager when it is the only thing going on, right? Where it for these 2.5 minutes, it's going to take over the screen and be the center of attention. And from that perspective, like, there's just not enough going on in it to work like that, right? Like, you look at a video like this and you're like it's kind of boring in that respect. But within the context of it being like something that you're going to pull up on the internet, the fact that it acts as a well, what's the word? The word's escaping me here for it.
Attention grabber?
No. Like, what are those? Like a visualizer thing that you would see. Is that what they call them?
A visualizer, like on a CD player, which Adam doesn't have.
Yeah. Okay. Like, so a visualizer, right? So like acting as something that is going to, like, you know, make some movement happen along with the music and be kind of in the corner of your eye. You know, it works perfectly well in that respect and it's perfectly cool. And I was just looking at it and thinking, like music videos serve such a different purpose right now than they did. And if you were to take this and transplant it back into that universe, it wouldn't seem like it's enough. And I don't know, just observation that's been sticking with me about it. I mean, like, it's totally fine given 2017, and the song is fine.
Yeah. I mean, but here's the thing, you know, Against Me is not known for their music videos.
Oh, I think they're not known for their music.
No, they're music videos. I love their music and overall they're fantastic. But they do have a tendency, not that it's bad, but what they do is they get like an artist to do these kinds of videos, more just kind of more visual art than and like an animated art rather than like a traditional music video. So like a lot of the videos that came out when they released the live album, I think it was 23 Sex Acts. They did, I think they had like two or three videos and they were just like borderline. They weren't lyric videos. They were just kind of like abstract art and animated art. And that was it. So I was not surprised when I saw this. I thought it was okay. This is one of the songs I really like from the album. But overall, I mean, it was, you know, there's just not much to, it doesn't really grab you.
Adam mentioned that how music videos have a different purpose now than they did in 1996. But I wondered, and not to hate on this too much, I mean, but I wonder if this is serving its intended purpose now. I mean, the idea for a music video now is either one of two things. It's either to keep someone's attention so they watch it and want to buy the album or whatever, or it's to create its own unique, interesting art piece. Does this create its own unique, interesting art piece? Well, not really, just kind of some images blended together. So does it hold my attention and make me want to buy the album. Honestly, I was just flicking through the video to, like, I didn't even watch, even though the video's only like 2 minutes, I was flicking through the whole thing to see if I was missing anything interesting, and the answer was not really. So I don't know if they're served by making this kind of a video when really if they just released the track, maybe if they just released the track, it would be less distracting than this video and would better serve their purpose. I think we mentioned Jeff Rosenstock. Him, more than almost anybody else, has proven that you don't need a lot of money to make a compelling music video. Those last few Bomb the Music Industry videos where he's on the roller coaster, or the other one where he's got all the cell phones around him. Those are cheap music videos, but they're extremely effective. And you're like, wow, I want to be in this party. I want to hear this album. Whereas this kind of like animated thing, it just didn't seem that interesting. And I think you would be able to make an animated story almost as easily as this, which maybe could hold someone's attention. And I don't want to be too hard on the artist, because maybe they just said to the artist, can you just put something together for us real quick? And that's what the artist did, you know. But I don't know if this serves the purpose of the band either artistically or financially, just by kind of having like this kaleidoscope type thing.
Maybe it's just that having, because I mean, you know, music videos went the way of like, you know, TV shows. You can watch it on demand now. I wonder, there's clearly a different purpose now, but I think that purpose might just be, hey, we put out a music video, and it's just another way to quickly now, because it's you can make a music video relatively quickly and cheaply. Just say, hey, we put out a new music video, and just get, it's just more for like getting attention and for PR maybe. But, and just like saying, hey, yeah, we put out this record last year. You should, if you haven't looked at it yet, check it out and buy it.
Yeah, I guess you're right. If they just put out just a video, I mean, just a song, people will be like, well, I can hear this on radio or whatever. Or not radio. Yeah. What's the website? Spotify. Why are you just posting out of YouTube? But you're right. And that is the littlest effort possible to create a new product to bring attention to the album.
Well, I'd say it's a step above.
The littlest effort possible.
I'd say it's a step above like the lyric video, which I'm not really sure. Like, I think serves about the same purpose.
Yeah. Well, listen. Here's a controversial, semi-controversial article. The Downtown Boys. We talked about them, I think, last week or the week before. They've put out their first single on the new album. The single, it's all in Spanish, and it's called Somos Chulas, No Sumas, No Somos Pendejas. It means, I know this, the second half is We Are Not Dumb. I think the first, we are smart, or we are bright, is the first section. The song quite surprised me in that it is kind of similar. Not identical, but it's got kind of a similar vibe to the first album. I thought Downtown Boys were going to pull a Ceremony or a Savages or even an F'd Up, where after signing to a medium-sized label, they kind of radically changed their sound to become more indie rock, if you will. This was not that. This was maybe a more complex and longer song, but it was still very much the Savage Downtown Boys that we liked on the first album, if you will. However, quite interesting, and you guys might say it's completely meaningless and asinine. But the band, much like Against Me when they signed to Fat Records, Downtown Boys are getting some heat for signing to Sub Pop, because Sub Pop is owned, at least in part, by Warner Brothers. Is that worthwhile exploring? Or is that...
I didn't know...
What's that, Ricky?
Oh, no, go ahead. I'll...
So is that worthwhile exploring, or is that really just, once again, the indie scene devouring on itself when there are much bigger enemies to fight? The argument, I guess, with Downtown Boys is Downtown Boys is so revolutionary. Their last album was called Full Communism, so anti-capitalism, so anti-oppression, that for them to sign to an entity owned by a major label is seen as hypocritical. That's not my argument, but that's the argument I've seen on the internet.
I mean, I didn't know that there was that people still got like really pissed off when people signed to
major.
Is Sub Pop even a major label?
They have a 49% stake that they sold to Warner Brothers, so they still have a controlling share, but Warner has a financial interest in them.
I mean, I can see it, but you don't. But you know, when it comes to signing to a bigger like indie label, like people get congratulated now. Like it's not like it was, you know, in the 80s where, you know, everyone yelled sellout to the person that
The 80s. I mean, like everyone was arguing over the stuff in the 90s still, right? Like,
The 90s too.
Like, I feel that like the bottom has fallen out on the music industry so much that for the most part, no one seems to care where you sign at this point, because it's pretty clear that there's no. On the one hand, there's no bag of money that someone is going to give you that doesn't have a clear consequence attached to it.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
What I was trying to get at there was that, like, so in the, we may have had some like naive days in say the, I don't know, let's say like the post Blink 182 era, right? Where you had a lot of bands like say H2O is a good example, right? It's like New York hardcore scene, punk rock band. They've released a bunch of stuff on Epitaph, which, you know, even then was a pretty big indie label. This was post Offspring Epitaph. So they had some money.
Yeah.
You know, they had decent distribution and everything else. But MCA comes calling and they say, hey, you know what? We're going to give you a big advance and a big record deal. And we're going to give you your shot at the top. And H2O, you know, they've seen everyone else get burned out on this stuff, but it was still during that era where you could like naively believe that, like, you know what, maybe we'll be the one that actually breaks through. And if we don't take this shot, we're going to be regretting never taking this shot. And then they go onto a major label and release a thing. And it's a, you know, it's doesn't sound like what, like the kind of band that got them their fan base, and completely flops and everyone turns on them, and then that's just sort of the end. You limp away from that. And you know, there was an era when that, where, you know, you could still be a band and enter into that kind of thing with like the vain hope that it wasn't going to happen to you. But I feel like at this point it's happened to everyone so much, to the point that when a band does take one of those deals, like, it doesn't matter, because we all know they're going to end up screwed. Like, I'm not going to judge you for taking that route, because both you and I know that you're not coming out of that anything else than fucked. And, you know, and then I don't know. No one's giving bands shit about signing with majors or whatever at this point, because you know what? Yeah, whatever. If you're going to do it, you know, no one's under the illusion that this is going to work out. So, hey, if you can pay for your new van out of the deal, then whatever. I sort of feel like that's the attitude right now with everyone. So as far as signing to Sub Pop, that seems like the least of anyone's problems. I mean, yeah,
Donald Trump is a president, people worried about Sub Pop.
I know, like the Sub Pop is pretty fucking innocuous if you're trying to like look for like the evil empire to go join up with. I mean, so sure,
yeah.
Warner has an interest in Sub Pop, right? Close to a majority interest, but it's not. And even if Warner does exert some creative direction stuff over Sub Pop at this point, the argument in my end would be like, well, who the fuck is Warner? Like, no one, they're not making rock bands anything important in the world at this point either. So
I think that has a lot to do with it, actually.
Like all of these companies are, you know, unless you're the label that's breaking, like I don't know, like, who's a big record at this point? Like fucking Drake? Like, unless you're the label.
Five Seconds of Summer.
I don't even know who that is, right? Like, unless you're the label that's breaking one of these like few bands that has like a some sort of YouTube hit or whatever this year, like no one at this point is moving that much of anything. So do any of these companies really matter at that point? I don't know. I mean, I cannot imagine getting mad about Sub Pop at this point in the world, but hey.
If I may point out, one band famously did take on the major label machine and came out better than they entered.
When was that, though?
1994 to 96.
Yeah, but, like, what bands now do well on a major label? I mean, I think an interesting example is, and obviously we don't know exactly what happened, but Teenage Bottle Rocket left Rise to go back to Fat.
Yeah, but Rise...
Well, hold on. John, what band are you talking about here? Because I'm trying to pierce them together.
Do you want me to tell you, or you want to continue the game?
Oh God! So signed prior to 94, out after 96,
right? And they have spoken nothing but positively of their major label experience. Now, I'm not saying they got mega rich, but they got richer and were very pleased with the product they put out on the major label.
Is this an interesting discussion, or is the answer the Melvins?
The answer is the Melvins. Okay. But what happened was, is Kurt Cobain said to the major label, he said, well, you should sign the Melvins because they're even better than Nirvana. And so Buzz Osborne said to them, well, okay, I mean, you can sign us if you want, but we're probably not going to make money for you, and we want total artistic control. And at the time, major labels were so desperate for the next Nirvana, they signed the Melvins to a, not an insane deal, but a fairly profitable deal. And Buzz Osborne said, okay, well, we're going to give them three records. We're going to do really, we're going to do our best on these records, but we're not going to expect anything else than put out three records. They put out three records on the major label, and they didn't re-sign them. And then the Melvins went on and kept the money and kept doing other stuff.
Yeah, I feel that like a lot of bands that came out of that era, all right. Like, I don't know. I don't feel like I'm mad at them about anything. Like, even bands that got signed up as part of some trend, like I don't know, like it does not seem to affect me. Like, look at anyone from like the ska punk era that had one of those deals. So like the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, right? They came out of wherever the hell various indies that they were on. And, you know, at just the right time, got their major label deal so they could go out and make a shit ton of money by being, you know, the backing band and fucking Clueless, right? And get the impression that I get in a million commercials or whatever. And you know what? For all those guys, probably made them a decent amount of money. And then by the time the band came out of that cycle, they were all old enough that they were on to other projects and it just became like a hobby band for them anyways. So, like, do I begrudge anyone there for, you know, making something of a living off of it? Like, not really. I'm thinking of like a band like the Suicide Machines, where,
yeah, they were on Hollywood, weren't they?
Yeah, like they're on Hollywood, or even something like
I would say that the best example to ponder this though is Chumbawamba, an explicitly anti-capitalistic band signing to a very pro.
I think that's different because they had history behind them, like before they got to that point.
Wait,
like,
so you think it was bad for Chumbawamba to do that? You're saying?
Well, I mean, maybe not financially, but like it was. I could totally see you being someone that's going to argue with Chumbawamba doing that by like an ideological standpoint.
But that's like, why people are attacking Downtown Boys.
But again, it's now. It just doesn't seem like it's that much of a big deal at this point that you're going to get mad about. I don't know. I mean, I think it was a different argument when these labels were, I used this reference earlier, but like when they were the evil empire, like when you were, let's say you're real big fish in 1998 and you're signed to Mojo, which is some label that really is, at the end of the day, Universal Records, right? So Universal Music, it's their ska imprint, but it's their muscle that's putting it out. And you look at Universal in the 90s and how they've got their fingers in everything. Like, they're a massive company. Half the media companies that you experience in the world are tied up with like them or Viacom or whatever, right? Well, at that point, when you're some cog in this giant machine like that, yeah, I mean, I can see that as being something that you're going to push back against. But like, you even look at like a company like Universal in today's like fractured media environment, like they can't move the dial culturally. Like, none of these major labels at this point can tell you, the average person on the street, to go pay attention to any music. If it's totally middle of the road pop, best they can do is take that song and, you know, get it in a bunch of commercials or movies or whatever. So, yeah, someone's going to make some money off of licensing deals and it's going to become like an annoying thing that you hear when you're, you know, trying to buy socks at Old Navy or something. Right. But like, outside of that, do any of you being you, like John or Ricky, like what's your experience like with media at this point? Like, you don't have to listen to commercial radio. There's a million things you could be listening to. You don't have to sit down and listen to like one of a handful of TV stations. You may not even be watching TV. You might be watching, you know, fucking some Netflix show or something on Amazon or whatever
Stranger
else, right?
Stranger Things is so good.
So there's, no one has like the complete like cultural dominance at this point. So signing to one of these labels, like, I feel like everyone knows what you're getting into. And then once you're even in there, it's not like the label has that much power to do anything with you that you won't, you know, be able to own yourself. Like, if Downtown Boy is signed to Warner Brothers, let alone Sub Pop, if they signed to Warner Brothers, it's probably mostly going to be Downtown Boy's effort making things happen or not. Like, they might get a higher priced publicist or someone working on their behalf, but, you know, what's that going to gain you? So let's say you get the best publicist in the world and he gets you the cover of Rolling Stone. Well, it's 2017. Like, who the fuck reads Rolling Stone, right? Like, there are people that read it. I'm not besmirching Rolling Stone, but, like, everything's fractured. Like, that one publication is not driving, like, what the youth are into, and nothing is. So there's so much less power in the media environment, at least in my opinion, than there was. So there's, like, less to get mad about as a bystander.
Man, I wish it was the 70s so we could wield our power over top of bands and publicists.
I mean, I'm amazed looking at how, like, stories about how The Clash got so much backlash for signing to CBS, right? Because, like, I wasn't even born at that point. But, and by the time The Clash became something that I was aware of, like, they were done. The career of the band was done. Their history was written. The arc was complete. And the musical, like, the historians of the music universe had decided that, like, this was a virtuous thing that is worth checking out. And all of the fervor over them signing to a major label was just like a footnote in a book. And it had so little to do with how subsequent humans interact with that music that it's sort of amazing to me. And again, that was a point where there was way less media that was competing for your attention. So something like CBS had a lot more power in that standpoint. Like, this point, like, Sub Pop even, like... Like, what else is Sub Pop? Like, did Sub Pop release the new Pissed Jeans record? Like, are we mad about that? Like, are you hearing Pissed Jeans when you go to, when you're at McDonald's trying to buy your hamburger? Like, no. So I don't get what's the problem.
Well, there you have it. Adam White giving his summation of the music industry in 2017. In my counterattack to Adam White's summation of the music industry and his disdain for CDs, I'm going to play a track off my newly acquired deluxe edition Slits double CD. I'm going to play Vindictive, which is on the second disc, which is from the Slits BBC live performance. It's their first BBC live performance. And this is striking for two reasons. First of all, it's striking how this was recorded 2 years before their album. And it's very interesting as to how Sex Pistol-y or clashy the Slits would be before they recorded Cut, their first album. Also, the editorial or the music critic standpoint of Cut is like, look how great the Slits are, even though they can't play their instruments. And that is frankly an incorrect statement, because as we will learn by listening to this track recorded 2 years before the album was recorded, the Slits certainly knew how to play their instruments. Cut doesn't sound like Cut sounds like because the Slits didn't know how to play their instruments. Cut sounds like Cut because the Slits decided to play their instruments in a very unorthodox, weird way, which only shows even more why they are a great and interesting band. As many musicians know, if you can't play your guitar, it doesn't sound like you can't play your guitar. Your guitar just makes no noise if you can't play a guitar. So, this is the Slits doing Vindictive, a rarer track, live at the BBC in sort of a Sex Pistol-y vibe. Check it out. Yeah. And that was the Slits doing Vindictive. Ricky Frankel, thank you for being on the podcast tonight. Are you still enraged about Downtown Boys signing to Sub Pop? Are you going to protest Downtown Boys, Sub Pop, or both?
Oh, yeah. No pizzazz there.
And Adam White, how pizzazzy are you feeling right now? On a scale of 1 to Richard Simmons during the classic 80s, sweating to the oldies era, what's your level of pizzazz?
I'm kind of coming down.
Coming down?
The latter, I guess.
Well, listen, thanks for listening to the Punk News Podcast. You can always reach that podcast at punknews.org, and we'll see you next week.